Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Devaghifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
The
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says its planned indirect talks with the US in Oman on Saturday will test Washington's intent and seriousness. At least 18 Palestinians have been killed in fresh Israeli attacks on Gaza's southern city of Khan Yunis. And the UN warns that over 2 million Palestinians are facing an acute hunger crisis amid Israel's total ban on aid entry into Gaza. Live from Tehran, I am Bahman Nouri, and this is News. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has described the planned indirect talks with the U.S. in the Omani capital on Saturday as a test to gauge Washington's intent and resolve. Ismail Baghaei said in a social media post that Tehran is giving diplomacy a genuine chance in earnest and with candid vigilance. He noted that the Islamic Republic will assess the other side's seriousness on Saturday and will respond accordingly afterwards. Baghaei also said the U.S. should appreciate Iran's decision for talks, which has been made despite Washington's, quote, prevailing confrontational hoopla. This Saturday's talks in Muscat will be attended by Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and U.S.'s regional envoy Steve Witkoff. Tehran has reiterated that the planned talks must take place from a position of equality, not under maximum pressure and military threats. The Israeli military continues to pound Gaza round the clock, killing more civilians in the Palestinian territory. 18 people, including women and children, lost their lives in fresh attacks on two neighborhoods in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Two other Palestinians were also killed in a strike on Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. Israel has been bombarding Gaza after around 2 months of relative respite. Since the regime ended the ceasefire there, over 1,500 Palestinians have lost their lives. The death toll from the genocidal war since October 2023 is nearing 50,900. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has once again sounded the alarm over the acute shortage of food in Gaza due to Israel's total ban on aid delivery. UNRWA warned that 2 million Gazans are inching closer to an acute hunger crisis amid Israel's suffocating blockade and genocide. The agency said Gaza's food supplies may run out within days unless urgent aid deliveries resume. It condemned the regime's continued blockade as collective punishment of the Gaza's population, calling for the immediate restoration of aid supply routes. Early on Wednesday, UNRWA had warned of the devastating impact of the Israeli blockade on children, saying over 5 weeks of siege have deprived them of food, water, shelter and medical care. Since March, Israel has barred humanitarian aid from entering Gaza, causing a drastic shortage of vital supplies. This has worsened the already deteriorating humanitarian conditions in the territory. Let us go to Tehran and talk to Dr. Syed Mohammad Marandi, Professor of University of Tehran, about tomorrow's negotiations. Dr. Marandi, welcome to the program. What should we expect from tomorrow's negotiations?
I imagine that Witkoff is going to take a very extreme stance, and then he will be met with a firm response. And then after that, possibly he will go to Plan B and put a more reasonable proposal on the table. Iran is not going to relinquish its conventional military capabilities at all. It is not going to compromise on that. It is not going to compromise on its support for regional allies. It has shown the Iranians that Iran, that it is willing to compromise within the framework of international law with regards to easing any potential concerns about nuclear weapons. We saw that in 2015, we saw that before 2015, and we saw it during the Trump, during the Biden years as well, when Dr. Baghaei was negotiating a deal, and we literally had a deal 3 years ago, but the Americans walked away at the last moment, even though the Europeans supported the final text. So the problem does not lie in Tehran. The problem lies in Washington. But Washington also has many other problems. It has a trade war that's not going well. It is fighting a dirty war in Ukraine, which has not come to an end. And with regards to Iran, Iran's defense capabilities and its conventional weapons would mean that any war with Iran or any major conflict with Iran would devastate the global economy and the U.S. economy in particular. So we'll have to see.
Right, Professor. President Donald Trump keeps threatening Iran with military action and at the same time expressing hope for the negotiations. Why doesn't he try economic incentives, for example? Does he believe that this will force Iran's hand, threatening Iran militarily?
Possibly, but we've seen that in his war with China, his tariff war, he lost. And Trump has changed position repeatedly, but the Russians continue to advance. And Trump's policies in our region have only created further hatred for the United States across the region and across the world. It's his support for genocide. So he's not in an ideal position. And Iran's defense capabilities could easily lead to the destruction of oil and gas facilities across West Asia and the Caucasus. And if there's war, there will be no more oil and gas. And that would mean that the price of oil would go up to hundreds of dollars before everything suddenly collapses, the global economy. So this is not a situation where anyone would win. A war is not something that the Americans would win. They would lose. Everyone would lose. And that's why the more sane people around in the United States, they know this, and they are probably pushing Trump to behave more reasonably. Again, like the trade war, Trump was pushed to retreat because it was about to devastate the United States economy. And he has created irreversible damage to the economy, as we've seen. But in any case, if he had continued with those policies, it would have led to a major and quick catastrophe.
And Professor, one final question. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said that Iran is giving diplomacy a genuine chance now on Saturday. But what is Iran's expectation, generally, from this negotiation?
Iran has always been at the negotiating table. Iran never walked away. It was Trump that walked away. It was Biden that walked away. And it was Obama that violated his own agreements. So Iran has always shown that it is always willing to talk. But this is another test for Trump. We have very bad experiences with Trump. He tore up a deal that many in Iran believed was unfair. But Iran committed itself to that agreement. All different political parties and factions in Iran, those who agreed with it and those who disagreed with it, they complied because it was something that the country agreed upon. But Obama did not abide by his commitments. Trump did not abide by U.S. commitments. And when he tore up the deal, he just showed that the United States is unreliable. And that's why it will be very difficult for Iran to negotiate with Trump, because Iran could possibly negotiate something on the nuclear program, and then the next morning Trump posts something on the internet, which is very different. So with such an unstable and unpredictable president in the White House, it is very difficult for Iran to negotiate anything meaningful and to be confident that deal will last.
Indeed, very interesting to get your perspective on the matter, Dr. Sayed Mohammad Marandi, professor of University of Tehran, joining us from Tehran, talking about the U.S. and Iran's negotiations on Saturday. Well, let us now go to Deir al-Balah and talk to Abubakar Abed. Abubakar, what are the latest news in Deir al-Balah and in Gaza?
Yeah, we've just got some breaking news from here. From Deir al-Balah, Israeli drones have targeted a group of civilians along the eastern outskirts of Deir al-Balah. We have a number of casualties reported. Until now, the ambulances have rushed to the bombed-out scene to take casualties from the place. But yes, we've just heard another explosion in that area, along with sporadic artillery shelling from the Israeli tanks that are stationed on the eastern edge of the city. And in the same area, in Deir al-Balah, the Israeli drones and warplanes have been constantly and intensely buzzing since the early hours of the morning. And in central Gaza overall, the military vessels are still moving or advancing in the sea and along the seashores, trying to unleash volleys of projectiles on those people, fishermen, who are trying to fish something for their families and for their starved families. And it's a very intense situation here in central Gaza. And moving to northern Gaza and Al-Shuja'iyah neighborhood, where the Israeli military has just issued a new evacuation orders for the population. A reminder that both Al-Shuja'iyah and Al-Zaytun neighborhoods, both of them, were ordered to evacuate nearly a week ago. Right now, the Israeli military has expanded its evacuation order to more areas of the eastern regions of Gaza, particularly along Salah al-Din Street. So that will take more neighborhoods, and that will force more Palestinian families to flee their devastated neighborhoods and seek out some sort of safety, although there is no sense of safety at all in the entire Gaza Strip. And moving to the same area in northern Gaza, to another area in northern Gaza, in Jabalia, after Israeli warplanes carried out a massive airstrike yesterday. Now, we have a confirmed local report of another fatality of just probably a 12-year-old child after Israeli warplanes targeted a residential block in Jabalia that left many casualties, including many fatalities as well. And we have now more evacuation orders in the eastern parts of Gaza City, where Israeli tanks are incessantly shelling those regions and incessantly shelling several neighborhoods in East Gaza City. Moving to the southernmost part of the Strip in Rafah, where also Israeli tanks and vehicles, along with the Apache helicopters and quadcopters, are opening fire relentlessly on people and civilians there and destroying more civilian structures inside the city, because Israel wants to expand and to stretch its buffer zone in Rafah and wants to take the full control of the city, not allowing any residents to move back after establishing the Mirage corridor. And in Khan Yunis, the overnight strike that hit Al-Farah family has wiped out the entire family, including 7 children. 10 people were killed, 7 children were murdered. All of them are under 10 years old, including a 3-year-old child. So this is just another family wiped out and erased from the civil registry. And this adds to nearly 1,200 families totally wiped out since the outset of Israel's genocidal war on the Strip. So this is just another bloody day in Gaza. And this goes in line with the catastrophic humanitarian and medical situation. The medical director of the Gaza Health Ministry has warned against the severe consequences of the current situation, particularly after all the medical supplies have run out from Gaza's hospitals. And those hospitals are right now working with less than the bare minimum in their hands, lacking every basic necessity. So he talks about imminent deaths among the injured if the crossings continue to be closed and unless the ongoing blockade is lifted. And let me just tell you in the end that this is a Jum'ah, this is a Friday day, today is a Friday. This is a time for the whole Muslim community around the world to sit with their families, a time for reflection, observation, and a time to have some time with their families. But Palestinians today, as I was walking around, they are weeping over their loved ones, they are sitting or they are mourning the death of their family members, they're sitting near the graves of their loved ones in the graveyards, And there's no time. This is a time to sit with a family for a feast. There's no food. This is a time to observe another day and to pray at mosques and sit and stand foot by foot in mosques. But unfortunately, Israel has destroyed over 80% of Gaza's mosques, so Palestinians cannot even maintain their worship. They cannot really enjoy this day. This is just another Friday without any sense of joy, without any sense of happiness, but just desperation and just desperation for everything and just continued despair for Palestinians and, of course, another blood-soaked day for the entire population.
Thank you, Abu Bakr, for the update. I would also like to use this opportunity to offer my condolences for the loss of so many members of your family just days ago. Well, Abu Bakr Abed, our correspondent in Deir al-Balah. A conference has been held in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, over the genocide in Gaza. Participants called on Muslim nations to unite. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has more to tell in this report.
Amid growing outrage over the continuing massacre in Gaza, Pakistan's capital on Thursday hosted the National Palestine Conference, where prominent leaders of political parties and heads of influential religious groups unanimously declared their intent to wage jihad, a struggle in defense of the oppressed against Israel and its chief backer, the United States. The conference, attended by thousands of pro-Palestine activists, was marked by fiery speeches, Quranic references, and emotional appeals to the Muslim nations to rise against the Zionist regime Israel and its Western supporters.
All Islamic states, including Pakistan, must stand and fight for the people of Palestine, even if it means risking the loss of economic support from the United States and its allies. We are not slaves to American interests, and we will never bow to Zionist powers. In these darkest times of Israeli massacres, we cannot abandon the oppressed Palestinians.
The Pakistani parliamentarians described Israel's military campaign in Gaza as unrelenting genocide, calling it the most brutal onslaught in modern West Asia history.
This genocide is Israeli genocide, but at the same time, it's also American genocide, because American dollar and American weapons are behind this genocide. Their diplomatic support are behind this genocide. So international community should come forward and stop this genocide.
Why are international human rights organizations silent over the killings of tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children in Gaza? Basic human rights, upheld by the United States and its allies, must be applied equally to the oppressed people of Gaza, whose lives and properties have been devastated by Israeli aggression.
The participants at the National Palestine Conference condemned the silence of international organizations, particularly the United Nations, over Israel's violations of the international law.
The Islamabad Conference also serves as a reminder that global support for Palestine is expanding across the globe, where people see Gaza not just as a humanitarian crisis, but as a moral test for the world. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news. Thank you so much. Stay with us for more.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
As the so-called liberal elite, more accurately described as the pseudo-liberal establishment, continues its retreat from key decision-making positions within Western regimes, an equally hollow pseudo-conservative force appears to be stumbling into power. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, as the so-called liberal elite, more accurately described as the pseudo-liberal establishment, continues its retreat from key decision-making positions within Western regimes, an equally hollow pseudo-conservative force appears to be stumbling into power. Rather than restoring order or coherence, this emerging bloc is accelerating the unraveling of the established imperial framework through a volatile mix of ideological confusion and political amateurism. while the political incompetence of the self-proclaimed conservatives is frequently on display, particularly through their flagship socio-political movement, Make America Great Again, the deeper ideological incoherence of this quasi-fascist current often escapes serious scrutiny. This oversight is unsurprising. Identifying such systematic contradictions demands a level of analytical rigor rarely found in sensationalist media or the performative discourse of social media. The term conservative traditionally refers to individuals or institutions committed to conserving or preserving established norms, institutions, or values. But this begs the question, what exactly is it that today's Western conservatives are trying to preserve? A superficial reading shaped by mainstream narratives might point to Christian nationalism as the defining ideal. However, this is a lazy oversimplification. A closer look at the political, intellectual, and personal histories of leading Western conservatives reveals that many are far removed from Christian values and lifestyles. Conservatives are, in essence, outdated liberals clinging to yesterday's liberal orthodoxy, albeit repackaged in a crude nationalistic aesthetic. This dissonance is not lost on thinkers such as Aaron Wren. Contemporary Western conservatism is largely defined by a single unifying framework, a preservation and resurgence of Western hegemony. From Canada's Stephen Harper to Germany's Alice Weidel, the common thread is a yearning to restore Western dominance, a goal often cloaked in alarmist rhetoric about defending Western civilization from Muslims. Ironically, it is this very objective that may hasten the decline of West-centric global order. By framing Muslims as the existential threat, these movements create dangerous blind spots, diverting attention from the real and pressing internal challenges their societies face, challenges that have little, if anything, to do with Islam. The clearest embodiment of this reality is the erratic and incoherent policymaking under the Trump regime. In the United States of America, the internal cannibalization of the conservative movement has already begun and is especially visible due to the primitive and emotionally driven nature of American political discourse. One particularly vivid manifestation is Steve Bannon's increasingly public attacks on Elon Musk, an example of ideological fragmentation within the movement. This internal collapse is also more visible in the United States than in Europe due to a growing realization among the Make America Great Again base that unconditional support for Israel may be detrimental to America's domestic interests and foreign policy credibility. Given the constant barrage of political spectacle for Trump, we will avoid focusing too deeply on the Make America Great Again phenomena here. Instead, let us turn our attention to Europe, a more sophisticated manifestation of Western neocolonialism, though no less troubled. Europe's political landscape is more deeply rooted in its historical consciousness than the carnival-like chaos of American politics. Yet, even there, the signs of deep internal decay are emerging. It is only a matter of time before modern-day fascists mimicking political movements across Europe begin cannibalizing each other. If history is any guide, this process will be particularly brutal. At present, the European version of this phenomenon is unfolding in slow motion. For instance, Germany's alternative for Deutschland, AfD, was recently expelled from its pan-European parliamentary group, Identity and Democracy. This rupture signals not only ideological divergence, but also strategic fragmentation. There are several reasons why this European cannibalization is progressing more slowly. Intellectually, the European left remains more robust and far more popular than its American counterpart. The pseudo-liberal elite in Europe, though weakened, still retain pockets of influence. Moreover, the twin specters of Islam and Russia continue to dominate domestic narratives in many European countries, offering diverse political movements a shared external enemy to rally against for now. Still, the trajectory is ominous. Europe, a continent that twice plunged the world into devastating wars, may once again draw on its historical memory to justify nationalistic revanchism. It is not difficult to imagine a future where one nation's sense of unjustly denied rights ignites a geopolitical chain reaction on the European continent once again. When the inevitable intra-right infighting among Europe's far-right factions reaches a critical point, the consequences will extend beyond the continent. The geopolitical implications will be significant, not only for Europe, but also for Russia, Turkey, and perhaps the broader global South.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Midstream. The collapse of the Assad regime in Syria, a new and dangerous competition has emerged, one that pits Turkey and the Israeli occupation entity against each other for influence over Syria's future. But what started as political maneuvering has now taken a far more aggressive turn, especially from Zionist Israel. As Turkey moved quickly to back the new leadership in Damascus led by Ahmed Sharra, better known as Abu Muhammad al-Julani, and strengthen its ties with armed factions in the north, Zionist Israel responded with force. Its strategy? Bomb first, negotiate later. Tel Aviv sees any Turkish expansion in Syria, particularly the establishment of military bases, as a red line. The Israeli regime has launched airstrikes on areas where Turkey planned to build strategic outposts, including near Palmyra and the Menag air base in Aleppo province. These weren't just symbolic attacks. They were clear messages. Zionist Israel will not tolerate any regional power operating militarily in Syria unless it serves Israeli entity interests. Turkey, on the other hand, considers northern Syria part of its security buffer, if not historically part of its own territory.
It has long pushed for a 30-kilometer buffer zone and has been working with the new Syrian government to set up military and training bases. But Zionist Israel is pushing back hard, not just with airstrikes, but also by pressuring the United States to curb Turkish influence. And while the Israeli regime claims it's targeting threats to its security, its broader agenda is becoming increasingly clear. It's working to dominate Syria's southern regions, reinforce its control over the Golan Heights, and position itself as the uncontested power in post-war Syria, even at the expense of its longtime trade partner, Turkey. What's more, Israeli entity military actions are being justified under the pretense of preventing strategic weapons from entering Syria, but they're also about shaping the country's political landscape. Zionist Israel opposes any Turkish-backed military infrastructure that might shift the balance of power. Meanwhile, the U.S. is trying to de-escalate tensions by expanding its own military occupation in central and eastern Syria, effectively blocking Turkey from gaining ground while keeping Zionist Israel calm. The irony? Turkey and the Israeli entity still maintain strong diplomatic and economic ties, even in the middle of this shadow war in Syria. But make no mistake, Zionist Israel's military aggression is about more than security. It's about reshaping Syria's future on its own terms and with force if necessary. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Syria enters a new chapter after the fall of Bashar al-Assad, the country has become the center of a high-stakes geopolitical tug of war. On one side, Turkey moves quickly to secure influence through alliances and military presence. On the other, the Israeli occupation entity responds with firepower and pressure. Tonight, we unravel how Zionist Israel is waging a covert war, not just to contain threats, but to claim Syria's future as its own strategic playground. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is retired Lebanese Army Brigadier General Elias Farhat. A pleasure having you with us, Mr. Farhat. Now, how do you really assess the Israeli occupation's military aggression and campaign against Turkish influence in Syria, especially the targeted airstrikes near Palmyra and Aleppo, in the broader context of its long-term strategy to try and dominate southern Syria and maybe neutralize regional powers?
Since the fall of the Assad regime in December 9 last year, Israel launched a preemptive aerial attack on all the Syrian army bases all over Syria, even the naval bases and, of course, of the Syrian coast. So these strikes were preemptive in order to avoid any emergence of a Syrian power or a Syrian army or something like this. Turkey declared several times or leaked in the news that they will build an aerial base in Tadmor near the T4, where there was an air base for the Syrian army, where many fighter jets of the MiG-29 and MiG-31 were destroyed by the Israeli army. Israel launched a preemptive attack before the Turks arrive at this base. Mm-hmm. They destroyed all the facilities in this base and all the infrastructures that will avoid any rebuilding or reconstructing a military asset there. Mm-hmm. But Turkey's presence in South Syria, you know that in Daraa, Ahmad al-Awdi is a pro-Emirati and never a pro-Turkish. And in Suwayda, it's something different. They are not pro-Turkish. So Turkey still keeps its influence on the north, where in the northwest, the branch of Olive in Afrin and the shield of Furaitis in Al-Bab and Minbij and the peace source in Ra's al-Ain. So they keep their pro-Turkish organizations such as Sultan Murad or Muhammad al-Fatih or Sulaiman Shah from their Ottoman names, you know that they are pro-Turkish. the Turkish influence now is on Mr. Sharia, the new president, and everyone knows in Damascus that in the fourth floor of the Four Seasons Hotel, there, it's all for the Turkish mission, which is directing the situation politically from there. But on the ground, the pro-Turkish forces are still on the north and did not move southwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Farhat, Turkey did present itself as a supporter of the Syrian people and the Syrian authorities, as you just mentioned, and an opponent of Zionist expansion. Yet, it builds military bases on Syrian soil and it backs armed factions that you just mentioned that have Turkish names. In your view, what are the real strategic goals behind Turkey's deep involvement, at least in northern Syria, not to start talking about Damascus at the moment?
Actually, Turkey succeeded in changing the regime in Damascus, but they failed up till now for the day after. They don't have any plan for the day after. They don't have any plan for the new regime, for the, their cooperation on the new regime. They tried to build bases, military bases, or something like this, as we said in Tadmor, Palmyra. But so far, there is an embarrassment in Turkey how to deal with the new situation, especially after the civil attacks in the Latakia and in the coast base, where massacres were committed by the new regime forces with some pro-Turkish forces. Definitely the Turkistan Islamic Party, which took part in these massacres. So they don't have really a real plan for what to do in the day after.
Mm-hmm. But they are trying to take control, as we said, of the political decision in Syria. How much are they going to succeed in that, given that they have their own problems at the moment in Turkey?
Yes, Turkey was the first to send an envoy to Turkey and met Mr. Sharia, who was the Minister of the Foreign Affairs, Hakan Divan. As soon as Sharia visited Saudi Arabia, they recalled him directly to Ankara, where he met Erdogan. Now Erdogan feels that Sharia is trying to get far away from him towards Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. Still now, he is Mr. Erdogan and Turkey, still they have the great influence on the new regime, but they don't have full influence after the Saudi Arabia and the Gulf interfered. And of course, they promised him with money and with assistance. And so far, nothing has arrived from this these aids or these supports from us. Still, the situation is very bad, especially the economic situation. 90% of these people are under the line of poverty. So, as we said, there are no plans either from Turkey or from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf for what to do with this regime.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Farhat, with both the United States of America and Zionist Israel, they are truly just actively working to block Turkey's military entrenchment. They're not hiding it either, while also consolidating their own occupations inside of Syria. How should the Syrian resistance, if there is any real Syrian resistance on the ground, respond to this three-way competition without being a tool in one camp against the other?
Now, in Syria, the media and the politicians are focusing on the failed regime, Mr. Assad, and the atrocities of that regime. But when Israel occupied Jabal Sheikh Mountain, and they advanced in Quneitra, and they occupied the Khan Arnabi and the Quneitra city, and they passed the the disengagement forces of the United Nations, and now they advanced to Damascus countryside and to
Daraa. They even killed civilians in Daraa.
Yes, they faced a civil or a popular resistance from the people, and they killed some in Daraa and some in Kuwaya as well. So the resistance, the idea of resistance now has emerged in South Syria, and I think it needs some time to be crystallized in organizations and groups in order to launch attacks on the Israeli occupation.
Who's going to be able to help them, Mr. Farhad?
Okay, they have their own help. Arms and ammunition are not a problem. There are a lot of arms and ammunition. Politically, you know that some parties in Syria, they are ideologically hostile to Israel, and they are a nationalist in terms of resisting any occupation, foreign occupation as the Israeli occupation. But so far, there are no axes appearances in this this resistance. I think that we need some time in order to crystallize this resistance and to see how it could be supported politically or military.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ilyas Farhad, retired Lebanese Army Brigadier General, for joining us to discuss the situation in Syria, which is escalating quickly. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the continuous genocide against the people of Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Tonight, we uncover the devastating reality unfolding in Gaza, a calculated campaign of annihilation carried out by the Israeli occupation with full Western backing. Entire neighborhoods have been flattened, families buried under the rubble, and over 50,000 lives, mostly women and children, lost. As the world watches in silence, Gaza is being erased in real time. This is not a conflict, it's a genocide. More details in the following report.
Here lies the full horror of Gaza's reality, a catastrophe playing out in real time, while the world watches in silence and complicity. The Israeli occupation army has expanded its ground operation deep into Gaza City. In the east, tanks have seized Al-Muntar Hill and the Shuja'iya neighborhood, raining fire on nearby areas. Simultaneous airstrikes and artillery barrages pounded Zaytun and Tufa, flattening homes and driving terrified families to flee. Overnight, entire blocks were obliterated in southern Zaytun. Further south in Rafah, Israeli entity warplanes bombed dozens of homes in the Khirbet al-Adas and al-Auda areas. Ambulances couldn't reach the wounded trapped behind Zionist Israel's siege. The occupation has completely severed Rafah from the rest of Gaza through the construction of the so-called Morag Axis. In Khan Yunis, even humanitarian zones weren't spared. Israeli entity helicopters targeted tents in Al-Mawasi, killing 86 and wounding hundreds more. The UN reports that 65% of Gaza's land mass is now under forced evacuation orders. Over a million Palestinians have been told to flee their homes, many for the second or third time, with no safe refuge in sight. Meanwhile, the Gaza municipality warns of a water crisis after Zionist Israel cut off the main water supply line to 70% of Gaza City, with groundwater wells bombed, fuel depleted, and pumping stations destroyed. Tens of thousands are without drinking water. The humanitarian situation is beyond dire. Food, medicine, and aid are not reaching those who need them most. The UN says there's no safe place left in Gaza, and yet the bombardment continues. Al-Qassam Brigade spokesperson Abu Ubaida revealed that half of the Israeli entity captives are being held in zones now under evacuation orders. They will not be moved. Their lives are in serious danger, he warned, urging immediate negotiations. All of this, the massacres, the siege, the famine, is being carried out with U.S.-supplied weapons. The silence of Western capitals has become complicity. The death toll has surpassed 50,000. Most are women and children. Gaza is being erased, neighborhood by neighborhood, family by family, while the world scrolls on. This is not war. This is a genocide, and it's happening in front of our eyes. And now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Saleh Abu Izza, political commentator. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Saleh. Now, giving the overwhelming destruction in Gaza with over 50,000 lives lost, entire neighborhoods just wiped off the map, and essential resources like water and medical aid being blocked, how do you really describe the scale of the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Gaza, and what steps need to be taken ASAP, immediately, to address the suffering of the Palestinian people?
نعم يعني حينما هدد ترامب بأنه غزة ستلقى الجحيم إذا ما أفرجت إذا
When Trump threatened that Gaza would face hell if the Zionist hostages held by the Palestinian resistance were not released, we are now witnessing that very hell unleashed upon Gaza. Journalists are being burned alive in tents set up near hospitals. Children are dying, decapitated, and the horror of the massacres has surpassed anything seen before the first truce, or rather the second truce, which is now in effect. In other words, the massive inferno engulfing Gaza today is unprecedented, especially after the United States opened its weapons stockpiles to the Israeli entity military, allowing it to pick and choose from an arsenal of colossal bombs that, incidentally, are not even justifiable by any military objectives related to Gaza. What must be done immediately is an end to this war and this unbearable suffering that the entirety of Gaza is enduring. Humanitarian aid must be allowed in. Not to mention the urgent need for shelter for a population that has, in large part, lost everything. 90% of people in the northern part of the Strip have lost their homes, and 70% in the south are in the same situation. There is an acute shortage of food, a severe lack of clean drinking water, especially after a water desalination plant in Deir al-Balah, in the central governorate, was recently bombed by the occupying forces, and a dire shortage of medicine. We are witnessing the catastrophe of this era, of this century. No place on earth, no matter how hellish its history, can compare to what is happening right now in the Gaza Strip.
Well, Mr. Saleh, the international community, particularly Western powers and some of the Arab states here in the region, have either remained silent or actively, blatantly supported Zionist Israel's actions in Gaza, despite the clear evidence of war crimes and genocide. How do you view the role of these states in perpetuating this violence, sheer violence against the Palestinian people, and what responsibilities do they bear in this ongoing tragedy?
نعم يعني أولا بالدرجة الأولى تتحمل المسؤولية عن الجرائم التي ترتكب في قطاع
First and foremost, the primary party responsible for the crimes being committed in the Gaza Strip is the United States of America. It is the main actor, the architect of the broader project to reshape the Middle East. A project whose flames have been ignited in Gaza and are intended to extend through Lebanon, Syria, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iraq, and Yemen. In this equation, the Zionist occupation entity serves merely as an execution tool, implementing what the U.S. desires. Washington relies on Israel's unmatched brutality to manage regional conflicts in ways that serve American strategic interests. That's on the part of the United States and the Zionist entity. But can we absolve the Arab states of responsibility for these crimes? In my view, absolutely not. Silence, or aligning with the Zionist agenda, makes one complicit. Tragically, we see some Arab countries expressing sympathy while doing nothing of substance to alter the Palestinian plight. Worse still, some remain silent because their positions are dangerously close to those of the Zionist regime, though they avoid making this alignment explicit. Then there are countries that have gone even further, forming an actual support front for the Israeli occupation. They have backed Zionist Israel's wars not only on Palestine, but also on Lebanon and other fronts. Some have fully adopted the Zionist Hasbara propaganda machine, broadcasting its narrative around the clock on their own media channels, as if we are no longer talking about truly Arab states that share identity, history, language, and religion with the Palestinian people. Therefore, yes, these states bear immense responsibility before the Palestinian people and must answer for the consequences of these massacres. Unfortunately, those who view the Zionist entity as a peace dove and blame the Palestinians for the ongoing conflict will pay a heavy price for normalizing with Zionist Israel and enabling the crushing of the Palestinian people. Crushing the Palestinian people will not end with them. If allowed, it will embolden the little Israeli entity to grow more aggressive, unchecked. In the future, we will not see Zionist Israel confined to its current borders. We will see an emboldened greater Israel stretching from the Nile to the Euphrates, encompassing much of West Asia, with no voice left to object. And by then, regret will come too late to matter.
يعني أي كلمة يمكن أن تسمع من هؤلاء ويمكن حينها يعني يندمون ولكن لا فائدة لهذا الندم.
Exactly, but Mr. Saleh, in light of the continued and overwhelming destruction in Gaza, with the Israeli occupation relentlessly pursuing its military campaign, what options, real options, remain for Palestinian resistance groups like Hamas or the Islamic Jihad? Is there any viable path forward for the resistance? And what role can international solidarity play in supporting these resistances?
للأسف علينا أن نعود إلى الأهداف الإسرائيلية الحقيقية. هنالك من يرى بأن ما تقوم به.
Unfortunately, we must return to the core of the Zionist objectives. There are those who believe that what Israel is currently doing is merely an attempt to pressure the Palestinian resistance in Gaza to release Zionist captives, treating the issue, as the saying goes, like the shirt of Uthman, a symbolic pretext rather than the true heart of the battle. The real confrontation centers around two fundamental issues, both of which serve the broader Zionist strategic agenda. The first is the disarmament of the resistance in Gaza. The second, following the removal of the Palestinian people's means of defense, paves the way for implementing Donald Trump's plan to forcibly displace the Palestinian population from the Gaza Strip. Alarmingly, some Arab countries are reportedly assisting the Israeli entity in identifying a third country to receive displaced Palestinians. There have been discussions, perhaps even involving Abu Muhammad al-Julani in Damascus, with some suggesting that the massacres along the Syrian coast were related to plans of relocating Palestinians there in place of the respected Alawite community, particularly after the recent atrocities in that region committed by groups aligned with the new Syrian authorities. Talks have also included Somalia, though Somaliland insists on international recognition as an independent region in the Horn of Africa, as well as other Arab and Islamic countries. In light of all this, it is clear that the Palestinian resistance is well aware of this agenda. Its first and foremost move to thwart the plan has been to safeguard its weapons. Interestingly, some U.S. intelligence reports, some of which appear to be fairly accurate, have estimated that prior to October 7, the combined fighting force of Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza was around 30,000 to 35,000 fighters. Today, those numbers are said to be nearly identical, which indicates that the resistance has fully replenished its manpower. In fact, many on the ground suggest that the numbers may be even higher now, due to the widespread spirit of vengeance among Palestinians facing the relentless destruction inflicted by the Israeli entity war machine. Therefore, the first crucial step in preserving the resistance and defeating the Zionist project is to protect the Palestinian arsenal. Equally essential is to maintain the deep, loyal, and resilient bond between the resistance and its supportive environment among the people. These are the two main pillars the resistance cannot afford to compromise under any circumstances. While it may engage positively with Egyptian, Qatari, or other proposals regarding stepping back from civilian governance in Gaza, and may even accept all related political solutions, it has drawn clear red lines that cannot be crossed. The resistance knows that the moment it surrenders its arms, the campaign will not end. Rather, it will resume with even greater ferocity, because the ultimate goal is not the captives, nor merely the weapons, but the complete removal of the Palestinian people from their land.
Mr. Saleh Abu Azza, political commentator, I want to thank you very much for joining us to talk about the ongoing genocide in Palestine at the hands of Zionist Israel with bombs made in the U.S. and its allies. Thank you very much, ladies and gents, for being with us. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher. Please stay with us.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, with me, Atta, the host of this program. I have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mahdi. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sayyid Mahdi, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion of the program, The Teacher, we want to talk about an important Islamic teaching and concept, and that is Ma'rifatun Nafs. Let's start with a general definition of what is Ma'rifatun Nafs, Sheikh Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. According to the Islamic teachings and doctrines, among the most important knowledge or pieces of knowledge that we can acquire is the knowledge about self, yes, or about soul and nafs.
Mm-hmm.
Because according to the Islamic teachings, the essential, let's say, part of the existence of man is his nafs or his soul.
Yes.
If someone can achieve the knowledge about the soul, it improves the person in terms of the personality, characteristics, faith, iman, and other, let's say, existential kind of characteristics.
Yes.
So that is why in the Quran, in the riwayat, and also according to the viewpoints of the Muslim scholars, we should focus and concentrate on knowing about ourselves, about the soul, about nafs.
Yes.
That what we are, mm-hmm, and what kind of creature we are. Because of what? Because once you know yourself, your characteristics, then, for example, you arrange kind of plans for yourself based on that kind of understanding and perceptions that you have.
All right.
If you do not understand what you really is or what you exactly is, then, of course, you cannot set any